Get 3 months of The Spectator for just £15, plus a free bottle of Paul Roger champagne if you go to spectator.co.uk/jingle. This offer is UK only and time limited.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week we choose some of our favourite pieces from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and on this week's podcast, Alexandra Shulman, the former editor-in-chief of British Vogue, reads her fashion notebook for the season. Sean Thomas looks to Korea and asks, is a demilitarised zone for Ukraine inevitable? As Ireland recovers from its election and Germans look ahead to theirs, Matthew Paris argues that proportional representation is a fraud. Adrian Danat explains the new exhibition he has co-curated. Fresh Window, the Art of Display and Display of Art, is at the Museum Tanguy in Switzerland until the 11th of May 2025. And finally, Philip Henscher declares he has met the man of his dreams, his Turkish barber. Up first, Alexandra Shulman.
Since I'm considering giving a small Christmas drinks party, I've been reading all the festive entertainment features. There are recipes for canapés. Does anyone actually make their own complicated snacks? Floral arrangements, garden illuminations, and individual cocktails. These suggestions are exhausting enough to put one right off the whole idea. All the experts interviewed on their entertaining skills share an insouciance about hosting, which unfortunately bears no resemblance to how I feel in the run-up. They don't appear to stress about numbers, are able to whip up simple, delicious food for a cast of thousands, and always hear the doorbell ring. They never seem to fret about whether it's necessary to have a coat rail and whether it's all too much of a crush. Or perhaps they just have staff so they can lie in the bath for an hour before with cooling cucumber slices on their eyes. When the props from the Crown television series were auctioned at Bonhams last year, I put in a bid for the Balmoral drinks tray. My bid didn't succeed, but if it had, I would have been able to use the cocktail Twizzler and glass to mix the Queen Mother's favourite tipple, gin and Dubonnet, from the recipe in Tom Parker Bowles' new book, Cooking and the Crown. It includes, curiously, good ice, which, according to Tom, should be hewn from frozen lakes. I trotted around the neighbourhood off licences for a bottle of Dubonnet, but there was none to be found. I came across Vermouth, Martini, Aperol, Cinzano, Puntime, and many unknown to me alcoholic offerings from Eastern Europe, but not a glimpse of Dubonnet, once the staple of every drinks tray. Undeterred, I ordered Uber to bring the Dubonnet from a distant supermarket so I could drink it that night. The result is delicious, although not for the faint-hearted, which is only what you would expect from the late Queen Mother who enjoyed her drinks. Even so, in future, I might stick to my regular, slightly less alcoholic sharpener, a vodka gimlet, one part vodka, one part Rose's lime juice, and any old ice will do. One way to ameliorate the financial hit of Christmas shopping is to make a tally of all the things you'd like to buy for yourself but have resisted, such as, in my case, a pair of velvet platform shoes. £160 in the bag, just like that. Resisting a manicure, another £27 saved. That makes it easy to convince yourself you are X amount in credit, which helps soften the blow for all that Christmas spending. The beat of the fashion tom-toms has been wrapping up in recent days over the question of who will be given the creative directorship of Chanel. Karl Lagerfeld's successor, Virginie Viard, was ousted in June, and Chanel is the biggest gig in town. Matthew Blasi, who is currently at the Italian house of Bottega Veneta, is rumoured to be front-runner. But I would be surprised if this came to pass, since so much of this job is to be a front-man, heading up publicity and generating spectacles around the world. Blasi does a nice turn in bags, but he doesn't strike me as having that big vision. Personally, I would like the role to go to a woman. Coco Chanel's skill was that she really considered how women lived their lives and designed accordingly, making trousers, cardigans, suntans and costume jewellery fashionable. We all know how rarely men seem to have any acquaintance with what we like to wear. The only problem is that there are so few women designers available with the experience and clout to run the house. For years, men have been handed all the big jobs. The best suggestion I've heard is to put Marc Jacobs in the role. No, not a woman, but with Sofia Coppola by his side. They would be the dreamiest team ever, but perhaps that's just a fantasy and will have to remain the stuff of dreams. What better place to promote your family than the privilege of a Spectator notebook? The Johnsons aren't the only Nepo family in town. My brother Jason's exhibition, Immerse, has just opened at the Rebecca Hossack Gallery in Fitzrovia. It's a magical collection of sculpture, photography, drawing, painting and illusion, inspired by how it feels to be totally immersed in the watery world he swims in, under the surface, every day, for an hour. Artist Mark Quinn has already snapped up two pieces, so hurry while stocks last. A much better Christmas present than another laptop.
That was Alexandra Shulman, and now Sean Thomas.
It is the strangest place, the demilitarized zone, DMZ, that separates South Korea from North Korea. It is simultaneously an historic battlefield, a somber graveyard, a tourist honeypot full of coach parties from Seoul, and a Cold War frontier, hotly defended on either side. One minute you are looking at a kiddies fun fair or a shop that sells souvenir North Korean money. The next you are staring at endless barbed wire and monuments to failed North Korean defectors, shot dead as they attempted to cross the 2.5-mile strip of landmines, which itself has turned into an Edenic eco-haven full of deer and eagles as the humans have vanished. In the middle of Injingak Resort, the touristy yet militarized focus of most DMZ visits, you can find one of those cute finger posts that points to various places around the world, the sort of thing you might see at John O'Groats or indeed in the Korean War sitcom MASH. In the DMZ, this multi-digit signpost points out that London is 5,500 miles this way, while Vladivostok is 460 miles that way, and so on. Missing from the signpost is Kiev, Lviv or Kharkiv, but they really should be there because, I believe, or fear, Ukraine is heading in the direction of a Korean-style DMZ, a frozen wartime frontier, a tragic armistice that might endure for decades. There are, of course, huge differences between these two conflicts. For example, Ukraine is largely a war between democracy and autocracy, rather than capitalism versus communism. But there are too many similarities for the parallel to be ignored. To explain why, I must describe my own experiences in Ukraine. I've visited Ukraine twice in the past 18 months, and both tours were as compelling as they were challenging. My first visit was to West Ukraine in late spring last year. My second was this summer. A 2023 trip revealed a nation full of resolve despite mounting losses. The toll of the war was sadly apparent. The citizenry seemed to consist mainly of women, children and older men. When I did see younger men, they were commonly in uniform or recuperating from injuries. Over a slender glass of wheat beer in Lviv's handsome main square, a recent graduate named Maxim spoke matter-of-factly about his impending conscription. Four of his university friends were already dead. The last one emailed me saying he felt lucky to be alive after losing his whole platoon, Maxim told me. A week later, he was gone. Such conversations became horribly familiar as I travelled onwards. Tales of loss related with a stoic fatalism. Nonetheless, Ukrainians seemed determined to win, whatever win might mean. By my return this summer, the mood had notably darkened. A promised counter-offensive had stalled into a war of attrition, dominated by defensive drones, mines and artillery. In Odessa, the constant hum of portable diesel generators was the soundtrack for a city struggling with Russian assaults on power grids. At the same time, Ukraine was scoring victories against Russia's Black Sea fleet, but it all seemed desperately tit for tat. The impact on Ukraine was likewise visible in Kyiv's Maidan Square. For each fallen Ukrainian, soldier or civilian, There was a small flag planted in the earth. There must have been tens of thousands. A vast yellow and blue bonsai forest of loss. I watched women weeping before this impromptu memorial, while young people arrived with fresh flags. The message was unavoidable. Ukraine is fighting hard, but it cannot sustain this carnage indefinitely, not without risking demographic collapse. Hence the need for some resolution, peace, or at least a truce. This may sound defeatist, like capitulation to Vladimir Putin's aggression, but we must confront the uncomfortable facts, just as the commanders in Korea did in 1953. Barring a dramatic shift in the strategic balance, perhaps through Chinese intervention or Russian economic collapse, Ukraine is following Korea's path. An armistice roughly along current front lines, while a bitter draft for all, may be the least worst outcome, perhaps the inevitable outcome. Putin has lost hundreds of thousands of men and risks civil strife. He too will need an exit ramp, some compromise he can brandish as a form of hollow victory. Meanwhile, Ukraine needs to staunch the endless bleeding of people. What might such an outcome look like? For the West, it means we must enfold surviving Ukraine as we once embraced South Korea, fortifying all our frontiers with vigour so Putin is not emboldened to go further. We will need to defend the Dnieper as we already defend the DMZ. There are still 30,000 US troops in South Korea, and Korea may need more to keep a stable peace now they've declared and undeclared martial law in Seoul. Europe will have to similarly step up in Ukraine. As for Ukraine herself, if Korea's DMC is anything to go by, then a frozen war might last a seriously long time and have some peculiar consequences. For example, as my tour group meandered through the DMZ village and stared across the front lines at silent North Korea, I asked our guide about defectors, and she told me some of their melancholy stories and their increasing difficulties in adapting to South Korean life. When I asked her why they found it hard, she replied, "One reason is language. In South Korea, we have absorbed many English words. Our language evolves. But in North Korea, the language has remained pure. They refuse new words. Even their grammar is different. As time goes by, it is harder for us to understand them." In other words, thanks to the artificial frontier, the Korean language is speciating into two separate tongues. It is easy to see this being repeated in a divided Ukraine as cultures and customs diverge, making any reunification much harder. After that, I asked the guide about that funfair at Injingak Resort, the jarring sight of carousels and dodgems next to tombs, tanks, and North Korean infiltration tunnels. Why a funfair? The guide sighed. "A lot of people ask this, why we have entertainments in such a serious place. The answer is, we have this fair so that when Korean families come here, their kids can have somewhere to laugh and be happy, while the older people cry."
That was Sean Thomas. Next, Matthew Paris.
Here comes a new law in political science, Joe's Law. As I write, the Republic of Ireland is still working out after its general election what sort of a coalition government will be entailed by its system of proportional representation. And the Germans are fretting already about whether and how a new coalition might be put together, the last one having disintegrated. A new election looms, held according to Germany's personalised proportional representation voting system. Joe, meanwhile, is a first cousin twice removed, whom I didn't even know. He's 16 and has a paper to write about our first-past-the-post, FPTP, voting system. Joe contacted me via his grandfather, my first cousin. We met on Zoom for a lengthy discussion, and from the back and forth, I developed what is for me a new and, I believe, strong argument in favour of FPTP, a repudiation of all those rival voting systems we call proportional representation, PR. I name it after my fellow explorer, whether or not Joe himself agrees with it. This is Joe's Law. Binary choices cannot proportionately reflect divergent opinions. A binary choice is between two alternatives, typically yes or no, between taking and not taking a course of action, whether or not, for instance, to take an umbrella this morning, where there can be no halfway house, or whether to use my savings for an annuity to support me for the rest of my life. Government in a democracy, the big policy decisions taken by those we elect to represent us, typically involves a series of choices that are, more often than not, essentially binary. Leadership means making binary choices. Example, some in this list have happened, others might. Choosing tax rises that target business. Acceding or not to a public service trade union's wage demands. Going to war to recover the Falkland Islands. Serious reform of the NHS. Substantially boosting defence spending. Cutting winter fuel payments for the elderly. Assisted dying. Gay marriage. Calling a referendum on EU membership. Letting go of the Chagos Islands. Sending illegal immigrants to Rwanda, leaving the European Convention on Human Rights, hitting China with punitive tariffs, letting Ukraine deploy our missiles against Russia, abolishing tuition fees or student loans, introducing a compulsory citizens' ID system. These are essentially do or don't decisions. Some, it's true, could be watered down as a compromise, but most depend for their efficacy on a crisp, stark, binary choice. Applied then to public policy, Joe's Law is fatal to what must be the ultimate purpose of proportional representation, policy that corresponds most accurately to what the people want. Different people want different things. A binary choice, yes or no, cannot reflect divergent opinions. Joe's Law is not, I emphasise, fatal to the idea of achieving a parliament composed of parties whose size mirrors the relative strengths of the many strands of opinion within the electorate. If the aim is that the size of political parties returned to parliament should correspond to the number of voters who back each, then PR can do that. FPTP doesn't. If there were only two parties competing, and if the proportions of their supporters were evenly spread across all constituencies, and 49% voted for Party A and 51% for Party B, FPTP would return every seat for Party B, but PR would return a house divided 51-49 for B and A respectively. Opinion is never spread evenly, of course, but in Britain, PR would still achieve a parliament that reflected different political parties' relative support more accurately than FPTP, which tends to throttle small parties by discouraging potential supporters from casting a wasted vote. PR, by contrast, by making each voter feel their vote counts, encourages a multiplicity of parties to thrive. Thus, elections in parties using PR rarely return a single party with an absolute majority, necessitating instead the formation of multi-party coalitions, as in Ireland and Germany, where this column began. When parties to a coalition cannot agree to a clear do or don't, the default position tends to be either don't or do a bit but not much. Both responses constipate decisive government. Both discourage innovation that carries risk. This deadening effect is not what people have voted for. Joe's Law tells you why. What PR cannot do, what a multi-party coalition struggles to do, is devise an actual programme for government, a King's Speech that itself reflects fairly the ideological composition of the legislature, or even those party to a coalition. This is because, however it is formed, the government faces binary choices and Joe's Law kicks in. Those binary choices offer little scope for folding divergent wishes together within a single decision. One or more of the partners must be overruled, or the decision fudged or deferred. In short, if you seek government representative of all rather than some of the people, not one but three fences must be cleared. First, you must create a parliament that looks as much as possible like the electorate that returned it. PR easily clears that fence. But then comes the second, to create from that legislature an administration. PR can clear that fence too, typically with coalition governments. But such coalitions then approach the third fence, making a programme for government that allows all participants to see their own viewpoints reflected in the choices made. And Joe's Law says you can't do that. Proportional representation therefore represents a fraud on the electorate. It offers them a polling booth experience that assures them their viewpoint can find a voice in government. And indeed, a range of small parties rocks up in the legislature, so voters believe the process has been fair, reflecting the national will. Next, a broad coalition government is formed. Good, voters think. A kaleidoscope of national opinion matched by a multicoloured legislature and now a multicoloured governing coalition. Only when this coalition must make policy choices, and so many of these prove to be binary, does this version of democracy cheat its electorate. Voters may not have agreed on much, but they did share a longing for one thing: clear, bold, and decisive government. The one thing PR struggles to achieve.
That was Matthew Paris, and now Adrian Denat.
Christmas. And in every city already, crowds congregate around the festive department store displays, in defiance of the apparent disappearance of the high street. For despite digital merchandising and online delivery, adults as much as children delight in this annual extravaganza, and such windows prove more popular than ever precisely because they cannot be enjoyed other than physically, in person. For many, these windows remain an indelible early metropolitan memory and perhaps the first experience of a work of visual art, something specifically conjured to arrest the attention, intrigue, and entertain. And now, just in time for holiday season, comes Fresh Window, the first major museum exhibition on this tradition, an exploration of the art of display and display of art. The show, which I have co-curated, presents a wide variety of artists who have used windows in myriad ways, but also elucidates how, in entirely practical terms, so many started their careers and literally survived by creating these commercial tableaux. For window display, or dressing, has traditionally been one of the very few regular paying jobs specifically suited to a visual artist. The exhibition takes place at Museum Tangley in Basel, dedicated to Switzerland's most famous post-war artist, Jean Tangley. My original inspiration as guest curator was discovering that he had actually trained as an apprentice window decorator, age 16, and worked as such for more than a decade. He was still creating windows when he moved to Paris, where his young artist neighbours, François Xavier and Claude Lalanne, also supported themselves by creating windows for Christian Dior, before going on to be France's most successful sculptor designers. But what seems remarkable is that even today, debutante artists still find themselves thus employed, a pleasing creative continuity. One section of the show, entitled Making a Living, deals with the celebrated artists who began as window dressers, not least Jasper Johns, oldest in show at a stately 94, who as a young man had his own window display business along with partner Robert Rauschenberg under the pseudonym Matson Jones. Likewise, Andy Warhol, represented here by a big wooden advertisement for Misty Gris perfume, did much such work, mainly thanks to Gene Moore, the fabled New York art director who supervised displays at Bonwit Teller and Tiffany. Moore not only employed young artists to work the windows, but also offered them the rare chance to show their own art in these most prestigious Fifth Avenue locations, and as such exhibited key pieces by Johns, Rauschenberg, and Warhol before any gallery. One of the lesser-known artists whose work has been recreated here is Shari Deans, a Protean Hungarian surrealist whose window displays for Moore have remarkably survived and are now seen again for the first time since 1955. But of equal interest are those artists who may not have actually dressed any windows, but whose oeuvre is inspired by their proportions and pleasures, whether Christo's early storefronts or Peter Blake's resonant sculpture painting, The Toy Shop, from 1962, or Duchamp's Fresh Widow that lent the show its title. Then there's the performance artist Martina Morga, who likes to lick those delicious luxury Paris store windows. Or R.I.P. Germain, meanwhile, builds ghostly and clandestine false frontages. A necessary sense of critique, rather than mere celebration of commerce, is provided by some. In Role Exchange, 1975, Marina Abramović swaps places with a prostitute in her Amsterdam window, while Vlaster Delamar demonstrates in a shop vitrine demanding the right to an orgasm at over 60, 2016. If vintage photographs of ancient stores by At J. Berenice Abbott and London's own Nigel Henderson picture a retail world we have long lost, our current shopping future is suggested in the final room. Here, an ever-morphing Instagram projection displays contemporary shop windows by artists, anonymous and acclaimed, across the world. A shifting simulacra, a feed of fleeting dazzle. Yet happily, the older artisanal tradition also continues, for in the new year, as a continuation of the exhibition, a select group of local art students at the very beginning of their careers have been commissioned to do whatever they so wish in various Basel storefronts. Who knows, in 70 years' time, one of them may turn out to have been as famous as Warhol. Fresh Window, the art of display and display of art, is at the Museum Tangley until the 11th of May, 2025.
That was Adrian Danat. And finally, Philip Hensher.
Just as you always hope will happen, I knew I had met the man of my dreams almost on sight. I had made a booking the day before I arrived. Burak was just finishing the previous customer and gestured with a comb towards an armchair. The Turkish coffee was brought. The customer paid and left, and I took his place in the chair before the mirror. "Now, sir," Burak said, with an ingratiating punctuality not quite his own, "what can I..." But as he was asking about the haircut, the nervous, pale English boy at the next station in the barber's interrupted. Burak, he said tremulously, "I wonder, would you mind if I borrowed you?" "Nah," Burak said, all ingratiation gone in a fierce flash. "Nah, fuck off." He turned to me. "I'm sorry, sir," he said, "but he is. He's a fucking thief. Now, what can I do for you?" And I knew I had met the barber of my dreams. I was somewhere into middle age when I discovered the joy of the Turkish barber and the bracing rigour of the process. There are the hot towels over your face twice, the circus trick of the twirling threads plucking your excess eyebrow, the flaming giant Q-tip batting at your earlobe and leaving a burnt hair stench behind. The cutthroat razor shaving the back of your neck as well as chin, and if you have a parting in your hair, they shave a 3mm parting too. And the 2 minutes of shoulder massage, both brutal and oddly perfunctory. There are technical discussions involved. Lord, the discussions about moustache wax I've had. It costs £60, but you need to find the right Turkish man. Plenty of people will tell you that £60 is far too much for a man to spend on a haircut. In my view, it's the £60 haircut that only needs a repeat 4 times a year. Anything cheaper and it grows out in a weird lopsided way after a month. Probably my worst extravagance was like Jane Austen's Frank Churchill in support of a haircut. A German friend had reported in awe about a monosyllabic Turk, a Kreuzberg genius with a cutthroat. The next time I was in Berlin, I went. My friend was right. 4 months later, I flew back to Berlin in pilgrimage, as if I were going to Bayreuth for Parsifal, just to get my haircut. There are Turkish barbers in London, you know, my husband said with some exasperation, tempered with lechery when I got back to show it off. It's an odd thing, a man's relation with his barber. I tried 3 or 4, hipsterish but hopeless, nervous with the cutthroat, and then I came to Burak, the barber of my dreams. By the best men's barbers, Burak scowled a great deal and had the distinct air of a thug with an asbo about him. We quickly bonded over dogs. He said, and I believed him, that dogs always loved him. Dogs adore a physically decisive man, and Burak didn't hesitate with a razor in his hand. By the third visit, he remembered me, and the conversation went on into bored, uncharted areas. You can talk about anything in a barber's chair, and Burak talked to his customers about everything. He had what my grandmother used to call a potty mouth. He liked, he said, a fat girl. And he went on into fond, contemptuous, detailed reminiscences. It was disgusting, but it was also brilliant, and so were his haircuts. It's commonly believed that women living together in communities come to experience synchronization of their monthly cycles. In much the same way, I and our schnauzer, Greta, had come to the same haircut timetable. I would drop her off at the groomer in Kennington, shelling out another £60, and head off with a light heart to be pummeled by Burak. One day I arrived and Burak was gone. Without a word, he had taken himself off to small town Turkey. Did he have what he referred to as a fat girl in tow? Hard to imagine. But small town Turkey, that really is too far to go for a haircut. I was in the park and bewailing the disappearance of Burak sometime later to a friend who had made the mistake of admiring Greta's new haircut. I'm just going from Turk to Turk at the moment, I said. It's not the same. I'm seriously thinking I might have to go to Berlin to get my hair cut again, like Frank Churchill going to London in Emma. My dog walking friend is quite literary. Well, she said, you do realise that Frank wasn't really going to have his hair cut. He was actually ordering the piano for Jane Fairfax. Can you realise? No, I said. You learn all sorts of things idly chatting in the park. Your hair's looking fairly good too, I should say, she said sympathetically.
And that's everything for this week. If you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd really appreciate a review and a follow, however you subscribe to your podcasts. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.